everyone, and welcome to a Horror Homeroom Conversations bonus episode. I'm Elizabeth Irwin.
I'm Gwen Hoffman.
Dawn Keatley.
And on today's episode, we're jumping back to the 1970s. Gritty, nihilistic, and at times exploitative, this decade is often heralded as American horror's golden age. Today, we're ranking our top 10, so stay tuned. Who wants to go first?
I mean, the 70s were my decade. Like, these were the films that I saw for the first time when I was young. Terrifying. So a lot of these just come out of having seen these films and been terrified. And that actually explains the number 10 is The Omen from 1976. I have watched this countless number of times on TV, and, well, God, that kid. I mean, he's just very scary looking. And the dogs. I guess the dogs always freaked me out when I was younger. And then the scene of the governess jumping from the house, you know, when he kind of makes her do it with his mind. But yeah, that's a classic, terrifying film. Number 9 is Carrie from 1976. And I think, for me, this is actually a film that I came to enjoy later through film theory. And it's just like perfect for sort of women's bodies, is abject, blood, all of that. Sexuality, reproduction, you know, women are repressed and then they just explode and burn everything down.
And Piper Laurie.
And Piper Laurie. I see, that's why I thought you put her number 1. Number 8 is Piranha, which is one of those films that I just love watching. Like, periodically, every few years, I'm like, I have to watch Piranha. And I actually kind of like Piranha 2, where the piranhas start flying. Alien is number 7. The chest-bursting scene with John Hurt, you can't beat that. And I think that this may be the first horror film where you see a strong female character who's not really marked out as female for almost the entirety of the film. She's just a strong, kick-ass protagonist. And that was kind of new for me, I think. Dawn of the Dead is number 6. This is my favorite Romero film, and just The Mall. 1978, The Mall was the thing, and this movie was set at the mall. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is number 5. This is actually one of the films that I have always found absolutely terrifying. I started watching it, had to turn it off, had to stop. I mean, it's just, this film plunges you in a world that is kind of so disorienting and alienating and terrifying that it kind of remains one of the scariest horror films ever made. Number 4 is the only film I put here that's a little off the beaten track. And I love this film from 1971. Steven Spielberg's first film, made for TV, Duel, about the truck that relentlessly pursues someone in a car. Famous actor, I can't remember his
name.
Dennis Weaver. Dennis Weaver, yeah. And then number 3, also Steven Spielberg, and actually similar plot, only this time it's a shark, not a semi-truck, pursuing. This film built tension better than any other film, and Robert Shaw is just, like, amazing in his speech about the USS Indianapolis. Number 2 is The Exorcist. Terrified me in a completely different way because the priest doesn't beat the devil. I mean, you know, the priest doesn't manage to exorcise Reagan completely and he has to jump out the window. I actually found that pretty terrifying on an existential level. And then number 1 just has to be what I think is the perfect horror film, Halloween.
Yeah, we knew that.
I mean,
It's actually probably my favorite horror film of all. Just because it's perfect in structure, it has the perfect monster, the perfect protagonist, terrifying, fabulous music. Every frame of that film is crucial. So I think every single one of these films is innovative, like is doing something different from what came before. So yeah, it was the decade of innovation. Also, and you mentioned this in your intro, nihilism. They are all extremely bleak. I'm looking at it. I mean, I guess Dawn of the Dead, two characters sort of escape at the end. Jaws.
So I actually don't have as much overlap with you as I thought I would. Because, I mean, my list is definitely pretty mainstream. And maybe some of my last minute edits kept me from overlapping with you so much. The 70s is my second favorite decade, of course, after the 80s. The 80s gives me the camp and the goofiness and the comedy and the over-the-topness, but the 70s still gives me some of that that I really, really love. It is very much in your face. They don't shy away from blood, which I enjoy. It's sometimes very unforgiving. And I think that's what's important about the 70s, too, is it really kind of laid the groundwork for a lot of horror. Like you said, it's very innovative.
Yeah.
And it really created some frameworks that are continued to be used later on. I mean, yeah, we saw The Evil Child before this, but I mean, The Omen, wow, sets the stage, you know? And yeah, we've seen Phantoms and Ghosts, but Amityville Horror kind of sets the stage,
I almost put that on my list.
Yeah, same thing with Exorcist. That sets a stage, too, that you don't really see otherwise. So I really do enjoy this decade, and this list was a good time. I did not rank my films so chronologically. I have Last House on the Left, and I guess I can kind of put right near there, too, isn't the other... I Spit on Your Grave, so from 78. Oh my God, if you don't leave those films freaked out.
Yeah.
Because those are things that could really happen.
Absolutely.
Really happen.
There's nothing supernatural about either one of them. Yeah.
I mean, it's in-your-face horror. Like, some of the scenes that they play out, you don't come back from some of that stuff.
I almost put Last House on the Left, but the little part with the weird music where it sort of sounds like some happy film, I just didn't like that part.
Oh, that's what makes it for me. Okay. I love that. Yeah.
And you know what? Interestingly, I was listening to The Spinsters of Horror, their podcast, and they do a podcast about rape and revenge films. And they bring up, they're really smart women, and they talked about some of the John Kenneth Muir books and what he's written about these rape and revenge films. And they definitely had an interesting take on some of these, whether or not they're exploitative or not.
Yeah.
And I really did like that. So if you guys don't listen to The Spinsters of Horror, check it out. I have Young Frankenstein. No shock to anybody. Black Christmas, which I've stated several times, is one of my favorite films because I think it kind of created that slasher film a little bit before Halloween. And it did it in a different way. And I think that we talked about it in our previous podcast, too, that if people would have followed that formula of Black Christmas, we could have seen a different kind of trajectory maybe for women in horror. Jaws, by far, is probably one of the most impactful horror films that's ever been created.
Yeah.
Because I think about it to this day, and, you know, I give lectures on trauma, and we use references to Shark to kind of help people understand, you know, experience with trauma and things like that. People that haven't even seen the film reference Jaws. They know what Jaws is. It's changed American psyche forever. Like, people are always going to hear that, and anybody that watches Shark Week is going to know. So I think it just kind of did something to our collective minds that no other film has really done on such a broad level, which is interesting, too, because the shark's not really even in the movie that much. So it says so much about that film. So I also had Carrie on mine because I do think that the Piper Laurie character is something so monstrous that I just loved it. I had Alice, Sweet Alice. So I kind of was going, because I love my Evil Children films, but I picked that one over The Omen because it kind of plays with what we think about kids, what's good, what's bad, what's innocent, what's not. I did keep Amityville Horror. I was back and forth between Exorcist and Amityville Horror, but I just think that what Amityville Horror did for just kind of that whole type of film was just different. And that whole idea, is it real? Isn't it real? Was it based on something? Wasn't it? You know, that kind of was Blair Witching before Blair Witching. And I think my last one was, I went with Day of the Animals, 1977.
Yeah, that, I love that film.
Because I think there's a lot of good in that film. And I think that was one last thing, that one last thought that I was left with the decade. I remember when you were talking about the 80s that there was a lot of formless things going on
formless
in the 80s. For me, there was so much nature horror that had gone on. So I listed, you know, you have Grizzly, you have Mako, you have Orca, you have Tentacles, Day of the Animals, Piranha, Barracuda, not to mention, too, your Jaws's. And that's really saying a lot about that decade because I was looking at some of the start and end dates of different things like the EPA and Greenpeace and Earth Day. And that was all really starting right around 1970. Yeah. And you saw a lot of legislation. So you've got your Clean Air Act, you've got your water quality improvement, and you've got marine protection, endangered species acts. That was when we were afraid that DDT was going to kill our national symbol of the bald eagle. So there was a lot going on during that decade, which I think that we might be able to dive into. I know we were talking about maybe doing a list for Earth Day going forward. So that might be on one of the next podcasts.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, I think I read somewhere that the 70s, too, was the first decade where people started to give warnings about climate change and global warming.
Oh, yeah.
So
absolutely. It doesn't Day of the Animals starts with them talking
about the weather,
the ozone layer.
And the ozone layer, that's right. And that's kind of what's making the animals go crazy,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. So they start talking about that at a very early time, too, in popular culture, at least.
It's been a long time since I've seen that.
Shirtless Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't know if that makes it more appealing or less appealing.
Oh, I'm an airplane fan. Naked Gun, Airplane, all those.
Yeah, but Naked Leslie, I don't know about. Yeah, so this was a tough list for me because I'm obsessed with 1970s horror. I love everything about it. I love its indictment on suburbia and the nuclear family. I love the way it plays with unpolished artistry, unflinching brutality, all that stuff I'm definitely here for. But the real reason I gravitate toward it is because of its exploration of taboos. And so I think you're definitely going to see this in my list. I think it's very interesting that so many of these films from the 1970s could not be made today. There's just not the cultural landscape for it. So
that's a good point.
And I do have two caveats to this list because, of course, the first is that I had a really hard time getting it down to 10, and I almost pulled a Gwen, but I didn't. But I did want to shout out Deranged from 1974, Vampires from 1975, and The Brood from 1979.
Oh, The Brood.
Oh, that's a good one,
All excellent films, all ones I would recommend. I also didn't include made-for-TV movies, which got rid of Trilogy of Terror and The Night Stalker, which definitely would have been on my list because I love those. So, number 10 is The Asphyx from 1972. It's a British horror. Oh, really? Oh,
no.
This is a good one. It's a British horror film, and it's about scientists who try to get as close to death as possible. So if that sounds sort of
flatlinery,
exactly, if it sounds like the plot to Flatliners, it's because it is, but it's done a lot better. And I think it's really interesting too, because if you look at that movie, you can sort of see the DNA in other movies, the execution scene in The Green Mile, also the whole idea of capturing a person's essence, which is in the Black Mirror's Black Museum episode. So one to definitely watch. Number 9 is The Hills Have Eyes from 1977. I actually prefer this one to Chainsaw Massacre, which I know is usually everyone else's favorite. And they do have a lot of similarities, especially how it depicts like rural environments. But what I love about it is that it just shows how tenuous civilized behavior is. And I really like Michael Berryman's performance. He creeps me out.
Can I just say that we were just talking about Oz, and somebody I saw on, I know on Facebook, actually mentioned that Oz is a lot like The Hills Have Eyes with the two families.
Oh,
I mean, what
right.
you just said about this tenuous civilized thing.
Yeah. Number 8 is Burnt Offerings from 1976. First off, I have to have Karen Black on the list because she's amazing. And if you have not seen Karen Black movies, you need to get on that. It's definitely one that straddles between mystery and horror. But what I like about it is that if you're into the Victorian Gothic at all, this would be the entry on this list that you should gravitate toward. If you've seen House of the Devil, you're going to be like, oh, wait a minute. House of the Devil completely ripped off Burnt Offerings. So, oh, and it has Bette Davis in it, too.
Oh, wow.
That's just an extra little side piece. Number 7 is one of my favorites. It's 1978's Magic. And this is completely psychological horror. It stars a very, very young Anthony Hopkins. And listen, there are a few things that creep me out more than ventriloquist dummies. And that's exactly what this is about. It's about a self-possessed ventriloquist dummy who has this completely weird and wild murderous agenda. And it's absolutely
like Chucky,
my wheelhouse.
Sort of.
Yeah, but almost creepier because, again, I just don't like ventriloquist dummies. I don't know. I see them and they freak me out.
I can't.
So...
I can't laugh, though. I'm scared of the troll from Cat's Eyes. So.
Well, this is my equivalent.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what to tell you. Number 6 is Death Dream from 1972. So 2 years before Bob Clark gave us Black Christmas, he gave us this story about a returning Vietnam vet. And it's sort of a vampire-zombie hybrid. But it's also really emotional and it has a lot of political subtext because he is a returning Vietnam veteran who has to basically consume people in order to stay alive. I mean, I don't want to give away too much, but that's the general premise. It is based off of the short story Monkey Paw, so definitely something worth watching. Number five is Deep Red from 1975. Most people I know prefer Suspiria, but what I love about Deep Red is that it has all of the same imagery, and there's this recurring motif of just, like, the hands that are encased in these black gloves. Ooh. And the way it plays. It's very creepy, cool. But very neat, the way it plays with, like, sort of color, and it also has deaths that seem actually plausible, which to me makes them scarier. Number four, we do have overlap, is Last House on the Left, 1972. This one obviously is not for everyone. As you explained, it's exploitative. There's a scene of disembowelment that's really, really tough to watch. But I think if you can sort of roll with it, it's a really interesting film about America and middle America specifically that I think is worth it if you can deal with the violence. Number three, again, more overlap, is Alice, Sweet Alice from 1976. I just really enjoy atmosphere. I enjoy color. I enjoy crazy homicidal kids. It is an American slasher, and it flips the switch a lot on what you expect in a killer kid. So I definitely appreciate that. And I also appreciate the way it plays with religion, because the film starts by Alice's younger sister is killed at communion. And it's a great ride. I definitely recommend that. Keeping with the killer kids is number two, Who Can Kill a Child from 1976. Yeah, so this is obviously my kind of subgenre. I like killer kids. It is a Spanish horror film. I think it's probably one of the better killer kid films that I've ever seen. It tells the story of a couple that winds up on an island inhabited by a gang of murderous tykes. And it's pretty much the Lord of the Flies on acid. And it's so good. Number one, this was so easy for me, which is surprising given the my complete obsession with these films. And that's 1973's Don't Look Now. And it stars Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland as grief-stricken parents who travel to Venice in an effort to start over once their daughter dies. She dies by drowning. And they arrive just in time to coincide with a murder spree. It's super unfortunate. I think that this film is known for the did they have real life sex or did they not in that one scene, because it completely obscures the really ethereal and haunting quality of the film. It has everything I love. It has grief, premonition, the occult, and a really, really innovative use of the concept of the doppelganger. So it is easily my number one of the decade. There's a lot of films to recommend. I'm surprised there wasn't more overlap.
Me too. All of us. I really thought there was going to be.
Yeah. I think we only duplicated two.
You and I. And then I think same thing here too.
We duplicated
Jaws. I think
we
edited each other. We edited each other out. Like, you were going to pick some of the ones I did, and I was going to pick some of the ones you did.
Some of yours, Liz, I haven't even heard of.
Yeah, so, you got her writing stuff down, man. Yeah.
So that's our list. If you agree or disagree, comments, gripes, or observations about any of these, we'd love to hear from you. We are at Horror Homeroom across all social media. And hopefully our next list is going to be on environmental horror to go with
birthday.
Yeah, that's great.
Does that work? Yeah.
All right. Until then, we will talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.